VA group. My sobriety date is August 27th, 1989. And like I said, as a member of New Day group, Ralph Vollen told me, come on out here tonight. So it's been a while since I spoke, so I figured might as well share a little bit of my story, my experience, strength, and hope. I guess I could start with way back, I mean, what it was like. I grew up as a Navy brat, and so I had built-in geographical cures from day one. We would move from one city, one Navy town to another, and the first thing people would say is, why can't you be like that boy Mike? He's such a nice little boy. 2 years later, about the time we were ready to transfer, be, stay away from that Ferguson kid. You're going to end up just like him. And so, you know, I had this up and down all my life growing up. My parents didn't drink a lot. My mom would nurse a bottle of wine for about a year. It would go bad before she'd finish it. My dad, I saw him drink to excess maybe twice in my entire life, and that was big celebrations and parties. But when they'd have a party, they'd mostly drink sodas. And I looked forward to growing up so I could go to these parties like them. I remember in going into 1960, New Year's Eve, they had a party in our basement in Waukegan. And they filmed it, so you know, I got to see all the fun and games of being a grown-up and having the excitement of drinking. I never drank, I never sampled it, I never snuck it at that time. I just looked forward to it one day. I didn't know I was going to end up being here. First time I remember taking a drink was at a wedding when I was about 10 years old, and they had the complimentary champagne, and I took a sip of that. I was like, ew, who would want to drink this stuff? Had another sip, and then a couple more sips, and I started sneaking a few glasses. On the way home from Los Angeles back to San Diego that night, I remember lying in the back of the station wagon, just looking out the window and smiling. You know, as the lights went by and the different shapes and the shadows, I thought, so this is what drunk is. And I remember thinking, this isn't as bad as I expected. I can put up with that booze if I ever had to. But I didn't go out looking for it or actively seek it for a while. And it wasn't for about 3 years later when I was raised as a Lutheran, so I was going through confirmation classes at the time. And on my way to church, I stopped by a 7-Eleven, ran into a friend who talked me into stealing a bottle or a can of beer, and got caught. So they called my mom, took me back to the church. You have to tell Pastor Spencer what you did. And I was all ashamed of myself. Dad was out to sea at the time, so you know it wasn't like wait till your father gets home. It's like wait till he gets back from deployment. And my punishment, Dad had left six-pack of beer in the bottom of the refrigerator before he left. My punishment was to drink a beer. And I downed it and said, okay. My mom said, I'm smiling at her, so she gave me another one. Have another one. And I was like, okay, downed it. Had the third one, and I started slowing down, backing up. And for a 12, 13-year-old, about that age, I couldn't guzzle them as fast as I wanted to. But then she sent me to my room as punishment, and I can remember that spinning, lying in my bed. My brother was in the bunk bed above me, and I just remember that the great feeling of that buzz, and thinking, I can't wait to do this again. Fast forward a few years, we moved to Okinawa, and as a 14-year-old over there, we didn't have any problem going off base, and we could buy whatever we wanted, whether it was slow gin, beer, hard liquor, no problem. And the first time I went out, it was that wonderful, sweet, sickening sweet Okinawan slow gin. I got caught with the MP by the MPs that night, and they threatened me. You know, they saw my dad was an officer, so they saw my ID card. They decided, just give me a warning. But that was just the beginning. And from that point on, for the next 4 years, it was either drinking, pot, back and forth. And, I still enjoyed my drinking. No matter what I was doing, I'd get away with it. And my mom would start buying me bottles of Valley High wine, so because she didn't want me to get high. She says, this is much better for you than pot, so here. And I'd go out and get high and then wash it down with the Valley High. And, you know, she had no clue. But, you know, that was back in the 60s, you know, we could get away with that stuff. We could, you know, police were looking the other way. They'd follow you home if you got drunk. And I got in the Navy after we moved here in 1970. And I got in the Navy shortly after that. And that's when it began to really take off. I didn't have parental control. I was, you know, certain places I could drink at 18 and 19 and I'd get away with it, or we were overseas. And my drinking just started leaps and bounds. I don't know when I crossed that threshold, and you know, where I lost control. But I can remember, I mean, I would drink. I was drunk when I met my first wife. She drank, we drank, we had a good time. My drinking eventually got to the point where after I'd gone to college, I spent my second enlistment in Albuquerque going to college, and that was, I remember getting to Oklahoma and going, can you smell that? It's Coors country, because that was before you get Coors out of this side of the country. And that was my fun, was drinking Coors and Olympia beer and partying with all the guys. And when I got commissioned and came back here to Virginia, I got on the flagship for Comm Second Fleet. So it was high visibility, and I was low visibility. If we had an officer's get together, I was the first one to pass out. If we had an outing for the department or a picnic, I was always the one who was hanging on to the last and taking all the extra stuff home. I was very visibly, you know, to everybody else, I had problems. But to myself, I can handle it. I can get away with it anytime. You know, I can quit anytime, right? It wasn't until 1983, and I'd just been selected for lieutenant, and I was getting ready to get my surface warfare qualifications, and the captain called me up and said, I'm not going to recommend you. I was like, what? He wouldn't come right out and say. He said, it's a subjective, you know, opinion. I can't put my finger on it, but he knew, and I knew what the problem was. So I ended up I didn't lose my commission, but I lost my surface warfare. I couldn't advance anymore. My punishment, get this, was spend the next 8 years until retirement up in Great Lakes, Illinois. So I had nothing better to do but go up there and drink. My wife and kids joined me up there. And after a few years, I was at the Reserve Center, which was right across the street from the golf course. And they had a nice 19th hole there and called Duffer's Den. And I spent a lot of hours there after work. In 1986, my wife left me for the first time. And she said, you drink too much. And she had called my parents. My parents called me and, you drink too much. I'm going, I can quit any time. And I proved it to them. I spent the entire month of July that year without a drink. No problem, I can quit anytime I want. Almost made it to my first AA meeting, because my wife was living with a girlfriend and she said, I'll meet you at this meeting over in Libertyville. We got to the parking lot, and it was about a half hour before the meeting started. We're talking, and she's talking about moving back, and I said, okay, well, let's go get something to eat instead. So that's as close as I got to AA. And I still didn't drink for the next couple weeks, but at the end of July, we went on vacation, came down here to Virginia, and the first night we were out in Sandbridge, and I picked up a 12-pack, and they used to sell the 2-liter bottles of wine coolers. And I figured that'll last me the week. Well, my wife announced, I'm going out with my girlfriends. She left, you know, she had friends here from when we'd been stationed here. And I was like, well, what am I supposed to do, babysit our kids? So I sat there and I got drunk. And I finished off both bottles of wine, all the beer, and proved to her that I still didn't have a problem. I could get away with it. I woke up in the middle of the night. It was my dad's camper. He had a Class C with the cab up over the drive and everything. And I woke up there and climbed down onto the mattress, and I thought I was in the bathroom. And I had this nice $700 brand new camera in its case and everything. which I proceeded to water. And I knew the next day I got problems. But, you know, I can still handle it. I continued to drink for the next couple of years, and until 1989, that was the straw that broke
the
camel's back.
Sorry, I'm still not sure about that.
It was 1989. Thank you, Siri.
Sorry, I'm still not sure about that.
Anyway, don't listen to her. Anyway, in 1989, it was on Father's Day, my oldest son and I got into a fight. He was going to run away from home, and he went next door and was sleeping in the neighbor's tent. And I chased him back to the house, and I had him down in his room. I knew not to touch him because I'd had a few drinks already, and I wasn't going to get that abuse. So I'm up in his face just, you know, calling him every name that I could. My wife came in and told me, just leave him alone, go to bed. Went up to our bedroom, got undressed, climbed into the bed, and she says, you go sleep in the guest room. I said, I'm sleeping in our bed. This is my bed, my house. You know, I'm sleeping here. And she tried to pull me out of bed. She tried to push me out of bed, and I'm just laughing at her, and she fell on her butt. And she said, fine, you want to sleep in the water bed? You're going to. And I hear some rattling down the hall in the knife drawer. And I look up, and here's this angry woman coming at me with a steak knife. And I'm going, this is before Loretta Bobbitt. So, you know, but I'm sweating. And I stood up, and as she swung the knife, I knocked it out of her hand. And as she reached for it, I went to kick it out of her reach. My foot followed through, hit her in the nose, broke it in three places, blood everywhere. And that instantly diffused the situation. You know, I'm so sorry. You know, sorry, we'll get over this. I knew the next day, she worked for the Navy Medical Command, so I knew that something was going to be said. And I went to work the next day, and I went into my executive officer, and I said, I might have a problem. Told him what had happened. I figured they were going to send me to level one treatment and just, you know, learn how to drink like a gentleman. And they sent me over for an evaluation, and they gave me the 20 questions for the alcoholic, and I passed to flying colors. They said, you're going to level three. I'm too busy. I can't go. And I refused to go. By the time I got back to my office, my XO was there saying, come here, you're going to either retire right now or resign right now, or you can volunteer. I volunteered for rehab against my will, against any desire. I never wanted to quit drinking. I just wanted to enjoy life, prove that I could drink like a gentleman. And I was sort of chuckling during the reading about more about alcoholism, because there was so much in there that described me, all the different attempts to quit, thinking I could get away with it, trying to drink like a gentleman, never happened. And I went into treatment. It took 2 months between June, it was the day after Father's Day when I was referred, and I didn't get in until the end of August, on August 27th. And I was at my bar every night, hanging out with my friends. Hey, I'm an alcoholic. Hey, have one on the house. You know, hey, have another one. You can't be an alcoholic. I drink more than you. These were the people I surrounded myself with. Some little dive bar in Winthrop Harbor, Illinois. I walked into treatment on the morning of the 27th of August, just defiant, hard-headed. I just knew it was just going to be a matter of time before I drank again. I don't know how many of you remember the old Cheech and Chong Big Bamboo album. It had a giant rolling paper in it, about that big. I've still got that somewhere around the house, but the album. But that was going to be my retirement gift to myself, that and a keg. I had 618 days I was going to have to go without drinking. Figured I could do that. My higher power for the next year, I went to meetings all through treatment. They introduced us to AA all around town, all around in southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois. And I learned to say the right things and, you know, quote the right quotes and sound real good just until I get out of treatment. And like a lot of the sailors, they had the forms that you had to have signed and for three meetings a week. And after the second week, I took it into our command DAPA and I said, here, I need a replacement one. I couldn't make it to all three meetings last week. I was too busy. His response was, that's okay, I trust you, you're an officer. Famous last words. So between October of 1989 and when I moved here in December of 91, I went to a grand total of 10 meetings. And that was just, you know, when my wife left me 8 months later because she knew I was eventually going to drink, I went to two meetings that week and boo-hoo, poor me, you know, my wife left me. Can you get her back? They said, we can help you stay sober. We're not going to get your wife back. So I don't need AA. Quit AA, never got my wife back. But a year later, the girlfriend I was with, she decided to leave. I went to three meetings that week, same thing. They weren't going to get her back. They were going to help me stay sober. And I didn't want that. Excuse me. My higher power during this time was a bottle of antabuse and fear, because I knew if I took the antabuse, I was going to get sick, and I'd heard all the scare stories on that. And the fear of losing my retirement also kept me dry. I won't say sober, but I just stayed dry. And when I moved here, I was living with my younger brother and my three sons, and he said, you need to go to AA. I don't need it. I've gone this long without it. He was in relapse, by the way. He'd had 5.5 years and was in relapse. He talked me into going to AA. And I walked into the side door group over in Virginia Beach, and I was home. Something about that group was the attraction, no promotion, just pure attraction. And a lot of fun people, a lot of laughter. I started seeing the same people night after night, hearing the same people share the same stuff night after night. And I got both critical and accepting of the group. And I fell in love with the fellowship. And for the next couple of years, the fellowship is what kept me sober. I was into activities. I was the chair. I chaired a lot of meetings there. Volunteered for, you know, the late nighters meeting 3 nights a week, and I was at the I was the group treasurer. And I finally got a sponsor who was more than just coddling me. And he started to walk me through the steps. And as soon as we got to step 5, I did my fifth. Well, I did the fourth step with his guidance, and then I did the fifth step with him. And he up and got transferred down to Florida, so I never saw him again. Got another sponsor, and he was another one of the easygoing, you know, do what you want, just don't drink, meeting makers make it, and saying the things that you know, I liked hearing, and not work the steps. But it was enough to get me by. I was doing the 1-2-3, 1-2-3, or the Tidewater two-step, I'm sick, let me share about it, 1 and 12, I'm sick, I'm sorry, 1-9-12. It wasn't helping me. My kids were just as defiant. They were still living. They were all at home still, about 13, 15, and 17 at the time. And when I came home one day, and I'm trying to tell them what to do, and the one looks at me and says, "You're nothing but a dry drunk." It's like, where the hell? Where did you hear that? And apparently, they had friends who were programmed as well. But I was targeted by them as a dry drunk. And it was one of those that sort of jabbed me in the back, and I said, I need to do something about this. And I got a sponsor who started working me through the steps. It wasn't any of this coddling. It wasn't any of the work a step a month, work them as you want to. You know, he was very, very serious about that, because how it works is, you know, it doesn't say work a step here and there or as you get to it. You know, I didn't want to do the cafeteria style, just what I needed and leave the rest, because he said it was fearless and thorough from the very start. And once I got on board with that, he started working me through the steps, and I continued actively working them. And I started getting things. The kids started liking me, talking to me. They bring their friends over and meet me. I was like, you know, this is nice. My kids actually like me. And the promises started coming true for me. I met another woman, and a couple years later married her. And that didn't work out. And she had some sobriety. It wasn't like I picked up on a newcomer. She had like 3 years when we started dating. The only good thing out of that marriage is my son here, Robert. He was my stepson. And when we split up after she started drinking, he decided to come and move in with me. And that was one of the proudest days of my life. When he came up to me, he said, can I change my name to Ferguson? It's like, Robert, I never adopted you. And he says, yeah, but you're the only dad I've ever known. And it was like, oh, I can feel the tears welling up. We sat down at the computer, filled out the paperwork. The next week, he's down at the court. You know, yes, I promise I'm doing right. And he was a Ferguson the next week. And it was, you know, that was one of the biggest, happiest days of my life. You know, he's been my buddy ever since. We've gone on cruises together. We've gone to Costa Rica together. We've done a lot and hung out and just, you know, been friends. And he's been in recovery. I had a roommate at the time, and Robert asked him, what do you do at those meetings? He says, come on, I'll show you. And went to his first meeting, picked up a white chip. It was like, been, except for a little mishap, he has been sober ever since. So, you know, it's made me proud to be part of this program, just to have, you know, a son that following my footsteps to some degree. I worked a lot of service work during this time. I worked as the treasurer at Side Door Group. I made the original website for Tidewater Intergroup when I was in between jobs, and I went and talked to Bill Ackerman, who was the guy who was the Intergroup rep at the time. And he said, I can't tell you you can do it, but I can't tell you not to. So I went ahead and did it. And a couple years later, after I'd been running this, I had 20,000-30,000 hits on the site. Somebody at Intergroup said, we own that name, you can't do it, we're gonna sue, and they got a lawyer and everything. So I ended up just turning it all over to them. They have it, they run it, they've improved on it quite a bit. But I was the chairman pro tem of the first Intergroup rep. When I moved to the New Day group, I've taken on a lot of chairing there. I mean, I chaired at a meeting. We have this policy, chair for a month. And I think I've done this, the one I do right now, I've done since February. That's been a long month. I chaired the speaker meeting and found, which gave me a reason to go to a lot more meetings. I didn't just keep getting people, say, from the group. I was going all over Tidewater and getting meetings at the time, because the service work was as rewarding as anything else for me. I was the group chairman, the group vice chairman. We became a corporation with newdaygroup.org. Thomas was a chairperson. We've had a lot of chair people for 2 years over the years. And we've maintained the same quality in our group, even though we've gone from 5 to 15 to 30. What do we got? 35 meetings a week now, 40 meetings a week. And we've had a good group, and it makes me happy to be a part of that group, because, you know, we see a lot of newcomers in there on a regular basis, and we help a lot of newcomers all the time, whether they're we used to get the alcohol rehab center people in there, and they were in there twice a week, and now they come in there on their own. They don't bus them in like they used to. And we still have a good turnout and a fairly decent success rate. I won't say, you know, we're better than or different, but it's a good group, and I'm proud to be a home group member there. Like I said, the fearless and thorough from the very start is what kept me in AA. The fellowship drew me in, and the working it actually is what kept me in. And I don't want to go over here. But there are a lot of things that I've learned over the years that I didn't want to. My higher power, as God as I misunderstood him when I came in, is the same God as I have now, but I understand him a whole lot differently. When I first came in, it was like, I'll get to you when I need you. And now I will make conscious contact I'll see a sunset. I'll thank you, God. I'll see something that just, you know, warms my heart. I whispered myself, thank you, God. I'm not driving along, pulling over to the side of the road. But I mean, I acknowledge where the miracles are. I'm not raising the sun and lowering it every night like I used to. I'm not in charge of the weather. I'm, you know, I go along with the flow. And one of my most favorite paragraphs in the big book is at the end of chapter 3. Because I, you know, every time I hear, oh, all you need is willpower, or, you know, just work the steps now and then, you know, this program is meant to bring us to a higher power. That's the main purpose of this. And the reliance on a higher power is what keeps us sober. In the last paragraph in chapter 3, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, and I don't think I'm that one of those cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. As long as I remember that, I've got a good chance of staying sober another day, because as soon as I start wanting to take over and stir things up and do it Mike's way, I'll start working Mike's program. And Mike's program is what got me in here. I didn't bring one tonight. I have these chips. On one side it says, the elevator is broken, use the steps. And on the other side it says, don't work your program, don't work my program, work the program. And I've emphasized that with my sponsees over the years, because my program got me here. Your program is going to keep you here for a while. But this working it your way, or the hunt and peck and the cafeteria style, doesn't work. I've seen that firsthand, and I've observed it in a lot of people over the years. I've had good times and bad times in the past 34 years. I met my third and final wife here in recovery at a picnic, New Day picnic, about 11 years ago, and we're getting ready to celebrate our 8th wedding anniversary soon. So we also like to travel a lot. We've been to 42 countries in the last 10 years. We've been on 48 cruises, and we've traveled through Europe, China, Mexico, Central America, a lot in the Caribbean, and I haven't found a reason to drink. I see drinking all the time. And if any of you have been on cruises, you know it's one big party atmosphere. And I see people drinking, and a lot of them become reasons why I don't want to drink, when I see them start stumbling and falling and getting pulled aside by security. The fighting. If you look on sites, there's been a lot of fights recently on Carnival, and every one of them has involved drinking. I don't want to get back to that, because as fun as it may sound, it's just not what I want today. My brother-in-law a few years back, he was a nearly a case-a-day drinker, and I was talking to him one day. I asked him if he wanted to go to a meeting. He says, oh, I quit drinking. It's like, what? He says, yeah, I just decided I was tired of it. And right then, I got that gnawing little voice in the back of my head and said, maybe you could just get tired of it too. You don't need, and right away, I'm at the meeting, I'm telling my sponsor, yo, I had these crazy thoughts today. And he says, don't drink. And I didn't. But I try to work with people who are willing, not just needing the program, because a lot of people need it, don't get in here. But this program, teaches us, there are people out there that just want to come in just for the same reason I came in for, just to get out of trouble. And just long enough to get their wife back, their job back, get the boss off their back, whatever. And I've had very poor success with those. It's the ones who are earnest about this program and are sincere and really want to stay sober. It says in the big book, AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain sober. Not being reformers, we offer only our experience to those who are experience only to those who want it. And I like seeing that light come on in their eyes. I like seeing the people when they actually get that, and the ding, and you see it coming true, and they start coming up, hey, guess what? And they want to tell you about their recovery and what they've done and how they're doing today. This is the stuff that warms my heart, and I just want to, I want to reach out. I want to come on, everybody, let's get in here and get sober. I know I can't do it, and I know no one person is going to be out there keeping everybody sober. It's a God-given program, in my opinion, and as long as I keep reminding myself where the power comes from. We, and as a group, will keep staying sober. There's been that time in the back of my head, like I said, you know, everybody talks about the relapse who walks back in and they pick up a white chip. They, oh, it's horrible out there. Oh, it's just as bad as ever. It's gotten worse. And I'm thinking, if somebody ever walked back into the meeting and said, hey, I was so drunk, I bought a lottery ticket, I won the lotto, I got this trophy wife, life's great, I just want to come back and say hi. You know, that voice in the back of my head's going, you can do that too, Mike. I got to work this program in order to keep that voice from telling me it's time to go drink again, because I like my life, I love my wife, I love my program, I love this way of life that I never thought I'd have. Now, 34 years ago, this time, I was a month away from going into treatment, laughing at all you, thinking it would never work, and it'll never work for me, and had no desire. But something clicked at the right time, kept me coming back, and I thank God every day that he brought me here and saved a seat for me when I wasn't willing. At the end of the meeting, when we say, keep coming back, it works when you work it. For me, excuse me, this program worked when I wasn't working it, because I had that little bit of spoon-fed AA in the back of my head. So, you know, whenever I thought, not tonight, that little gnawing voice kept saying, not tonight, Mike. And it kept me coming back until Mike was ready to start this program for himself. It's really about it. I don't have a whole lot more to add. I do like to wrap up with one thing. This is from the old preamble that was out and about in like the 1940s. We have our preamble that's a couple paragraphs long. Now this was a whole page. But the summary at the last two paragraphs said, I wish to remind you that whatever is said at this meeting expresses our own individual opinion as of today and as of up to this moment. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are free to agree or disagree as you see fit. In fact, it is suggested you pay no attention to anything which might not be reconciled with what is in the AA Big Book. If you don't have a Big Book, it's time you bought you one. Read it, study it, live with it, loan it, scatter it, and then learn from it what it means to be an AA. I am glad I am an Alcoholic Anonymous today, and I'm glad I got to speak. Thank you very much for putting up with me tonight. Thanks again.
Okay, our seventh tradition basket. Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers rent and supplies for the group. The rest is distributed to our AA service entities.